Welcome to the Stay Informed podcast. I'm your host, Tom Oshiewicz, VP of Legal of Informed. And today we're going to look at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's evolving views on innovation. Whether you are a fintech, a customer of fintechs, an innovator within your own firm, or just into public policy, how the CFPB treats innovation matters. It can shape the growth arc of the industry. So we have a great guest today to dive into this topic, Mike Silver, a partner at Hush Blackwell. He recently joined the firm after over 12 years at the CFPB. Hey, Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Let's just start out, Mike, by telling us a little bit about your background at the CFPB and what you're up to today.
So I started at the CFPB in September of 2011. So that was just about 7 weeks after the agency officially was up and running. So I don't consider myself a founder per se, but I was definitely there in the very early years and stayed until about 4 months ago. So I had 12 and a half years at the agency, and we could talk about kind of the totality of the experience, which was just amazing in so many different ways, helping to build and grow the agency from the ground up, working on many, many different policy initiatives, including, you know, some with you, Tom. We were teammates in the RMR, Research Markets and Regulations Division, for several years. Just really happy to be here and talk more specifically about the CFPB's approach to innovation issues.
Great, and I can't imagine that there are many folks who had the chance like you to have seen the Bureau go through all its stages. I'd really just love a couple of high-level observations about what you think about the Bureau. I'll start off with one. You know, I've done a lot of startups, and the weird thing about the Bureau was I've never seen a startup where you have so many incredible resources and such lousy technology combined in one space. It's sort of the opposite of startups where you have one person and the most incredibly new AI system. So just tell me, you know, as you've watched the Bureau grow, what's your sense, your experience of watching grow from, you know, 2011 just at a high level to where it is today?
I had a lot of the same observations, Tom. I think the way that I would summarize it would be the Bureau went through a process of bureaucratization as opposed to maturation. And I don't mean that entirely in a pejorative way. I mean, I could talk more specifically about my thesis, but you're absolutely right. You know, I have not worked at a startup company in the past, but just my understanding of the culture, the dynamics, the work environment, the energy, all of those things were present in the early years at the CFPB in a really interesting, almost novel situation where you have a startup within the federal government. It's very rare that new federal government agencies are created. The only one that I can recall within the last 25 years, other than the CFPB, is the Department of Homeland Security. And that was really just a compendium of reorganization of existing agencies. This is a new agency that was founded, started from scratch, absorbed both people and legal authorities and mandates from many other agencies and new authorities from Congress. So it really was just an experiment in a lot of ways. Specifically, we talked about how we both worked in RMR. RMR as an office, as a division, is itself quite experimental. Most agencies that are financial regulators and federal agencies, my understanding is that the rulemaking functions, for example, are run out of a general counsel's office, as opposed to an interdisciplinary policymaking division.
To interrupt you for a second, what is RMR?
RMR is the name of the policymaking division at the Bureau. So this is research, markets, it's now called monitoring, but for many years it was research, markets, and regulation. So it's basically three legs of a stool. You have the research functions for the agency where you have economists and research assistants crunching quantitative data, doing all sorts of empirical analysis. They sit alongside a markets expert such as yourself. You were in that office for a long time, who come from, in many cases, industry-specific industry segments. And then you have the rule writers, where I sat. I was in the Office of Regulations, who are the experts on the technicalities of the agency's regulations under its purview. The CFPB has a separate legal division, which is more akin to a traditional general counsel's office that focuses on litigation for the defensive litigation for the Bureau, institutional legal risk, and those types of things. But it's unusual that you have this three-headed hydra of sorts where the policymakers are kind of looking at data, they're looking at markets trends, and they're looking at rule writing all together. And so in the early years, I think it was a very interesting integrated environment. But getting back to the larger point, over the years, in my experience, and maybe you could share yours too, Tom, I think there was an inevitable bureaucratization. It is a federal government agency after all. There's well over 1,000 people. There were administration changes. And over time, of course, you're going to lose that ethos from the very early years. You have a talent drain, people kind of cycle in and out, particularly people who were really excited about being in that new environment the first few years. And I think a lot of the people that remain are more of the people that are focused on spending a larger portion of their career at an agency. And of course, the agency has to eventually get more process, more well-built out mechanisms internally. So my critique, however, and I wrote an American Banker piece.
It's a great piece, folks, by the way, check it out.
No, thank you.
No plug.
Excellent plug. As Tom knows, I have two daughters, just like Tom, and one of them just turned 12. And so I made the analogy to the Bureau being essentially like a preteen, and just like my daughter, she's awesome. She's going to sleepaway camp for the first time. She's so smart. She's growing, but she's not quite mature. And that's really where I think the Bureau is in its life cycle. People forget how young the Bureau is because it's in the crosshairs, it's in the public eye, and particularly in the space where we play in, it's so primary to the discussion. Some federal agencies are over 230 years old. The Bureau is only 12 years old. So it just simply hasn't developed the internal culture, norms, institutional processes that provide that continuity over administrations. And because also the Bureau has gone through two Supreme Court constitutional challenges, it lost one, it won the second recently, it's created a dynamic where you have basically a four-year term for each director. And that, I think, changes the incentive. It makes the leadership more focused on getting their agenda through in 4 years and not really paying as much attention to institution building. And I think it's had a pernicious effect, frankly, over the course of the last many years, because I think the foundation is not really solidified. And that allows political leaders, frankly, on both parties, over different administrations so far, to sort of put their imprint on the agency and on the organization, not just on policy. And rather than sort of strengthen the career staff and strengthen the institutional processes, which will produce more durable and more consistent policies.
That's great. And one thing I wanted to sort of get your take on is that one thing that I think is, an advantage, but also perhaps a source of instability for the Bureau is the fact that it has a single director. And what that means is, on the one hand, if the single director is focused, they can take that Bureau faster than perhaps other types of agencies because all the information is centralized. On the other hand, you can have a yo-yo effect, which we might talk about later. So I'm curious, from your perspective, going through four directors, do you think there's a certain amount of instability inherent in the structure of the Bureau just because there is a single director?
It's a great question, Tom, and it's been a source of public debate. This is one of the issues that is perpetually a criticism of the Bureau by certain stakeholders, particularly the critics on Capitol Hill. They compare and contrast the Bureau to the Federal Trade Commission, which by definition has a five-member commission that's bipartisan, and the FDIC, which has a board. So I do think, that was identified by the Supreme Court in 2020 in the Celia Law case as a constitutional flaw of the agency's structure. You're asking like a slightly different question, sort of how does it affect things from a policy or a management perspective? I personally think that, I think it contributes to the problem, but it's not the determinative factor of the issue. because I don't, I mean, I worked briefly at the FTC during law school during the summer. I haven't worked at other agencies, but knowing people that have worked, you know, people that at the CFPB who used to work at other agencies and friends and colleagues, my sense is that the probably the best argument for a commission is that it provides a formalized structure for criticism and dissent within the agency. Well, so you have a public mechanism to air those policy differences. Beyond that, I mean, you're seeing at the FTC right now a lot written about you know, the current chairwoman Lena Khan, how she's sort of breaking norms and taking different interpretations of longstanding legal principles and things like that. And you know, you see things like at the FCC where they've done the yo-yo, as you said, with the net neutrality rules going back to the Obama administration. You know, if you have 3-2 majority, then you could basically pass whatever rule you want. So in a sense, I think a commission is sort of overrated as a policy mechanism to sort of guard against overreach or the yo-yo effect. But I do think maybe on the margins, it would have some impact. I think the bigger issue is really the fact that the CFPB director, in conjunction with Celia Law, which again, just for a moment to explain to your audience what that is, it basically was a constitutional case that where the Supreme Court found that having a single director that could not be fired by the president unless there was a reason for cause, that violated separation of powers principles because it didn't allow the president to properly hold the CFPB director accountable. And that was one of the mechanisms in the original agency structure to try to guard, to make the agency truly independent, along with the appropriations, getting appropriations from the Fed. And so now the agency director can be fired at will by the president. And that's what happened when President Biden came into office. Kathy Kraninger resigned on the first day. So I think the combination of having a single director and a single director who can be fired at will by the president does change the incentives to make the director kind of more, you know, really have an agenda that is more aligned with the policy agenda of the administration and also on a four-year timeline.
Great. And Mike, I just have one last question before we dive into the meat of our conversation, which is, I love, you know, I've had a couple other people from the CFPB on the show, and one of my favorite questions is, what might surprise people about it? And just to give you an example, I think a lot of people don't realize how small the CFPB is. When you think about the compliance staff of some of the larger financial institutions, they are larger than the entire staff of the CFPB, which runs around, I guess, about 1,600 these days. So I'm curious, from your perspective, is there something about your experience at CFPB that you think people would really might be curious or surprised about?
So I would say two things. One kind of relates back to your question about what was it like in the early years. Particularly in the early years, it was a really quirky place, like kind of bizarre in some ways. You know, there's just all sorts of anecdotes that you know, I had, and you know, I'm sure you shared, because it was this like clash of cultures, you know, where people were coming from different agencies that had their own cultures, and other people were coming from law firms like I had come. And so it was just, you know, you'd show up and there'd be a holiday party, and someone would be in a full-on Elizabeth Warren wig and red coat and doing like a method acting thing. And then, you know, we had an office space negotiation with the employees union and management, which like got contentious because, you know, this is like the most obsolete issue in history. Like the fact that there was this big internal fight over office space and people getting private offices or sitting in shared space when like post-COVID, so many people were, you know, working remotely and still are. I remember a meeting we had where to kick off this process, like somebody sort of gave a speech that sounded like the coach from Friday Night Lights. got everybody like really jazzed up. You know, we're gonna work together and we're gonna solve this problem. And so yeah, it was a strange place, like a fun and energetic, but like a bizarre place, like trying to kind of work through those early issues. But the other thing, I mean, maybe that's not surprising, but the other thing that I think maybe isn't surprising too, but I'll just say it, is I think there's a lot of perception out there that the Bureau is always speaking with one voice, or that anything coming out of the Bureau, whether it's written or a speech or a blog or a tweet, that there's some sort of like, there's always an intentionality to everything, and there's always a kind of a three-dimensional chess component to it. And I think that you know, may be true sometimes, but I think a lot of times it's more of a function of, it's a bureaucracy, it's a large organization, it's messy, there's not always good communication internally. And you know, it is sausage making when it comes down to it. I mean, when we would write rules and when we would recommend policy decisions, you know, for leadership, you know, there were compromises made, and the way that you analyze things, you're sort of looking at all different angles. And so I think there's a lot of times people look at the results and they just make assumptions about ideology or things like that, when often the process is really just sort of messy and almost legislative in a sense. So I think people give too much credit to the Bureau sometimes in thinking that, you know, there's always like a second or third layer behind things, like rather than just sort of like taking it as it is.
You know, it's funny, I just thought of something which is like 30 years of my memory, but I think in like Lord of the Rings or something, like the Eye of Sauron, where you can see all knowing. But here you have it, folks. You know, the CFPB are just folks too. So that's great, Mike.
We're all fallible human beings, and you know, we made mistakes, and you know, but we were trying our best to do right by the American consumers.
Well, hey, now that we've sort of had this sort of inside look at the CFPB, I wanted to sort of really dive in now into the focus of our podcast, which is on innovation. And one thing I wanted, people may not be aware of, but innovation is actually part of the mandate of the CFPB. If you look to section 1021 of Dodd-Frank, and it describes the purpose of the Bureau, it actually speaks to innovation. It says that the Bureau is authorized to exercise its authorities to ensure that markets for consumer financial products and services operate transparently and efficiently to facilitate access and innovation. So literally the words innovation are in the purposes of the Bureau. So let's talk about the Bureau's approach to technology and innovation. As I said before, this is something that matters to all of us in industry, because we're trying to develop new products that work for consumers. We're dealing with new technologies. Often the regulations that were designed in a certain technological era, whether it's paper or digital, and how do you move forward? So I just wanted to sort of, if we could sort of let a framework for how the CFPB is approaching technology over time. So let's talk about the Cordray era first. You know, maybe you could give a little sense of, you know, that history and how Cordray approached it.
Yeah, so this is obviously, this is the lodestar topic here. This is a really juicy one. I would say, you know, it's kind of like set the stage from my overall view. There certainly has been an evolution from what was really more of a mindset around ways of creating space and creating regulatory flexibility to more of a tech skeptical approach under the current regime. And, you know, I think under Cordray, frankly, at least from my vantage point, it wasn't as much on the radar. I think there was just so much going on. You know, the first 2 years of the Bureau, at least in regulations, were entirely occupied by mortgage rulemakings. We had 7 mandatory mortgage rules to write under the Dodd-Frank Act, because that was really the derivation of the financial crisis. You know, all went back to mortgages. And then after that, there was kind of a demand had built up for other initiatives. You know, so we dove into small dollar lending, payday, card title loans, and debt. You know, there was a team stood up to work on debt collection, which was a 7-year rulemaking. So, you know, there was an effort called Project Catalyst, which you, I'm sure, remember. There was a very, very active person heading up that initiative, Dan Kwan. And they were talking with a lot of different companies, but at least the public perception was that the program like had potential, but didn't really take off. So I think by all accounts, it was viewed as just sort of standing still. I will say that within the payday rulemaking, you know, that was a 5-year project. And some of the things we were looking at were starting to get into these issues that are now much more prevalent. You know, we were looking at early notions of cash flow underwriting, you know, when we were meeting with different stakeholders who were trying to come up with alternatives to traditional payday lending products. And, you know, there were early versions of earned wage access products, you know, which used technology to expedite payroll processing to give people a way of smoothing their income. So there were kind of early hints of these issues, which are so much more prevalent. I mean, I think some of this probably dovetails with the evolution of fintech and that segment of the consumer credit market in general. I know there was so much an explosion of activity, and, you know, in the late 2010s and, you know, early in the Biden administration. So I think where with the CFPB, where they really put a priority on it was under Director Kraniger.
Before we go there, I just want to ask one quick point, which is that it's called Project Catalyst, right? So when I think of
Project
the word
Catalyst, Catalyst
from my perspective implies spurring quicker action. And so I would posit that perhaps, although it wasn't a high priority, the notion of innovation was that we can do things as the CFPB to make things go faster, to help progress move forward. Would you agree with that assessment, though? Even though it wasn't a priority, it was still the notion of innovation. There's a way the CFPB could spur activity, that government could be a positive force towards making innovation happen faster.
Yes. I mean, the name itself, it was a nice branding, right? I mean, catalyst, you know, is catalyzing something. And in that case, it was innovation. I agree with you also in the sense that I think part of the thrust of a lot of initiatives in the early years of the Bureau was to try to do things differently. There was a lot of innovation, or at least talk of innovation, like within the walls of the agency. And I think that was a sense of like, let's try to do processes differently. Let's not write long memos. Let's write PowerPoint decks, you know, because we don't want to be a stodgy regulator. You know, we're a 21st century agency. I mean, I think some of the branding notions of what the agency was were translating into a notional ideas of how to do things in an innovative way. But in terms of sparking or catalyzing that innovation in the private sector, I don't think that really became a priority for the agency leadership until Kathy Kraniger took office.
Two other quick points on that, or maybe three, but a couple of things I would note. One is that, as I recall, the major development of the entire Project Catalyst was the no action letter with Upstart in 2017. And that Upstart, for those folks who don't know, is a company that uses AI technology to help support, or at least at that time, to support underwriting. And why that's relevant, if you think from the credit reporting space where I hail from, that concept of credit reporting and the laws around it are very rooted in a paper-based system and in technology that has a limited number of variables. So if you, for example, have adverse action notices, they talk about the top three or four adverse action notices. That makes a heck of a lot of sense when you have a model that has 12 variables. But when you have a model that has 1,000, maybe that isn't as productive. So point number one is they were already thinking about technology, but also they only got one. My recollection is we were able to get one letter. So that's it. We have this thing. We're starting to think about innovation. We're starting to think about AI. There's one action, and then the administration ends and Kraniger comes around. So bring us in a Kraniger. You know, what were they trying to do that was different from the previous regime?
I think they were trying to catalyze. If we want to keep going with this with this you know set of puns here, I think you're absolutely right that the concepts were there. It just wasn't executed in a way that had broad impact. I think what Director Kraniger did was just sort of put more resource and prioritization into it. I mean, they stood up an office. They hired an assistant director of the Office of Innovation, Paul Watkins. They brought a number of people on detail from other offices in the agency, you know, over to the Office of Innovation. And they wrote three different policies. They wrote a no action letter policy, a trial disclosure waiver policy, and a compliance assistant sandbox policy. And those had to go through notice and comment, and that took about a year and a half, you know, for them to formulate the policies, respond to the comments, and then issue the policies. And then while that was all happening, I was actually leading one of the teams that was developing the first actual no action letter under those new policies. And what's really interesting is that that first no action letter was issued to HUD. It had to do with housing counseling funding. Like, it was a RESPA Section 8 issue for the audience. RESPA is an anti-kickback statute. You can't pay for referrals. And there's been this longstanding issue where housing counseling agencies provide free mortgage origination counseling to credit-constrained consumers, sometimes if they're turned down in the underwriting process. And there's been cuts to the funding of these agencies. They're funded traditionally by Congress and through the HUD, Department of Housing and Urban Development. HUD rules allow lenders to fund housing counseling agencies, but that fact pattern kind of implicates the question about whether there's a payment for a referral, because the housing counseling agencies, when they're finished with the counseling, they often will refer the customer to the lender who paid for the counseling services. So there's kind of like a question of whether is that a steering situation. So the theory was that lenders would be more willing to do these arrangements if the Bureau could issue some guidance or clarity saying this is not a RESPA violation, or even if it is, like, we're not going to enforce it. So that ended up being the first no action letter, where we worked with HUD to issue a no action letter on behalf of the 1600 housing counseling agencies, and then set up a mechanism to allow follow-up applications from lenders. And then that ended up resulting in a few lenders like Bank of America applying for and receiving no action letters. So there were a number of other no action letters, and most of them were more of like the traditional, that's an oxymoron, traditional innovative bucket, like for the more garden variety notions of innovation, things around new technology or AI. But the program was kicked off by that initiative, and I think the theory was like, this is sort of an innovative use of Bureau resources and guidance, like, to try to solve this policy problem through this program.
I'm gonna throw a thesis out at you, Mike, and tell me if you agree with it or not. I just want to see if you would agree that whether it was more the same or something slightly different. And here's what I mean, that my sense of the Cordray era was that, hey, we're excited about innovation, we want to help. And that with Kraninger, it was a little bit more like, you know what, we recognize that government actually often gets in the way. And it's not that government can support innovation, government is actually the barrier to innovation. And that it's not so much that government can help by getting out of your way. And I'm just curious if you have a sense that there was a different view of the role of government in Kraninger, and that perhaps the notion was that government actually already is stepping on the foot and we're trying to clear the underbrush. I'm curious what your thought is on that.
I think your thesis is accurate, Tom. I definitely think that that was a big thrust of why Kraninger put the emphasis on the innovation function. It was the notion that regulatory ambiguity or regulatory questions or the overbrush, as you said, was potentially stifling innovation and the development of new products and platforms. I don't know that it's necessarily the case that the Project Catalyst did not move forward as quickly as people hoped, because there was a different philosophy about regulation or about the role of government. I think it might have just been more of a function of, at that point, the agency was only 5 years old and they still probably had a messy process, and there was a lot of consensus building efforts, and it might have been the case that they just couldn't get consensus on moving forward with more than one output. But I think you've hit at a very important point, which is something I was going to emphasize, which is that the approach to innovation that Kraninger and the team took was really intertwined with their approach to providing regulatory guidance outside of rulemaking. And, this was partly a function of when Mick Mulvaney was the acting director in 2018, the Bureau did this broad request for information to the market, basically asking for input on, Tom, you remember this, we were involved in another project related to that issue, where basically seeking feedback on every rule, new rules the Bureau had issued, rules that they inherited from other agencies, saying what's wrong with these rules, what's right about these rules, what should the Bureau do to potentially change them. And a lot of the feedback was, rules are unclear, statute or the rule itself is ambiguous, Bureau hasn't issued enough guidance to clarify the rules of the road. And so I do think part of the innovation function and the fact that they stood up like these different tentpoles, you know, within the innovation function, you know, where some of them were more about just agreeing not to enforce if something was ambiguous, you know, whereas others were more like forward leaning in terms of a sandbox or a trial disclosure, like letting there be experimentation with new disclosures. I think that reflects the underlying policy choice that the Bureau should be doing more to clarify its own statutes and regulations, where, and, you know, you made this point earlier, where like in some cases, the rules or the statute was passed 50 years prior, and there just is very little, you know, rules or guidance or even best practices to try to figure out how to apply those old laws and regulations to things in the modern day in terms of technology, business arrangements. You know, I came to the innovation piece at the Bureau largely from the perspective of RESPA Section 8, as I mentioned, because I was the lead of the Bureau's policy work and regulations. And RESPA was passed in 1974. To your point, Tom, you know, it's a mortgage statute that, you know, mortgages in 1974 were, you know, everything was done on paper, you know, more referrals of, you know, realtors to customers from realtors to settlement agents or title companies, you know, it was all done in person or over the phone. And obviously now things are automated. Things are completely different from a technology perspective and from a business arrangement perspective, you know, how the whole ecosystem of the settlement process is organized and flows. And yet you have this statute where there's very little clarifying commentary in RESPA and Regulation X. And so all these companies were starting to come to the Bureau in 2018 and 2019, like, hey, we're thinking about building this co-sharing online platform, co-advertising platform. You know, how do we navigate RESPA Section 8? Like, we're looking at, you know, general counsel letters that the general counsel from HUD wrote in the 2000s. You know, HUD used to own RESPA before the Bureau. We have this guidance, this informal stuff, like what do we make of it? How do we kind of package it into telling us how to comply as we build out this new platform? And that's where the thinking was starting to happen. Like, well, this is a new tool for the Bureau to try to move the needle in a sense by working with individual companies to try to sort through those issues and then, through the issuance of a no action letter or a sandbox approval, kind of make a statement or put down a marker about how the old law applies in the new day.
I have so many questions you've raised, but I want to make sure that we get through the whole arc of the history of innovation. So we have Kraniger, which sets up an office, innovation. They have all sorts of staff from different parts of the Bureau running to support innovation, reaching out to industry saying, hey, how can we innovate, having all sorts of meetings with companies all over the country to get their feedback. And then there's a change in administration and Director Chopra comes. What happened next?
There was a shift. It wasn't an immediate shift because there was an acting director for 8 or 9 months during the Biden administration. So things were quiescent in a sense, but then in, trying to remember the exact timeline. I think it was in the middle of 2022. Director Chopra put out either a blog post or some sort of announcement that they were basically restructuring the Office of Innovation, and they were rebranding them as the Office of Competition and Innovation, and that they were essentially walking back some of those innovation policies, including the no action letter policy. And the stated reason was that they believed that the prior policies were ineffective or hadn't adequately achieved their intended goals. I mean, I think it's pretty clear, particularly looking back, you know, since then, that they just had a completely different view of what the Bureau should be doing in that space. And they just fundamentally don't believe in the idea that the Bureau should be engaging with individual companies on the industry side to provide one-off regulatory relief. They think that that's sort of unfair to the market at large. It sort of favors companies who have connections or resources that where they're able to engage with the Bureau in that way, and that the better way to issue guidance is to do broad-based guidance through many different mechanisms. And like I've done other podcasts and webinars like talking specifically about this topic of like guidance under the Chopra era. There's just been this blitzkrieg of things coming out of the Bureau, policy statements, circulars, interpretive rules, advisory opinions, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's been, I think, very conscious on their part to try to advance policy goals through an incremental approach where they're using these other tools, which are not notice and comment rulemaking. So they're not going through all the formalities and the time of a rulemaking process, but they're having a lot of impact. And you know, now that I'm on the other side advising clients, you know, there's a lot of kind of confusion, anxiety, feelings of being overwhelmed by all this stuff. And so, again, I think just like I said earlier, that the stand up of the innovation office under Kraniger, I think in part was driven by the philosophy that the Bureau should be doing more to resolve regulatory ambiguity. I think this shift was driven by kind of the opposite side of the coin of the same issue, you know, just a philosophical shift about how the Bureau should be engaging with the markets. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, so now we've had, I would like to offer the perspective of the business coming in here. So I guess one question I'd offer you is, do you think that innovation is going in the right direction at the Bureau? How do we get a balanced policy? I would just sort of raise from my perspective as a company, one of the things that a company wants is stability, right? They want to be able to, you know, one of the most important things is to say, if I make an investment, will that investment pay off? And do I know that there'll be basic accountability? The other thing is that I want to make sure that if there's a law that is based in, you know, 1492, that I can actually get some people to listen to me. Just to give you an example, it might be collections, right? So at some point on collections, they had something, you know, answering machines, right? And there's that people would have in houses and people were concerned about leaving messages. And now nobody even has a home phone anymore. And so you have to sort of adjust. So where are we at with innovation, and is the CPB doing, where should it be going? Is it going well right now, and where should it go if it isn't?
That's an excellent question. I think it's a bit of a eye in the beholder, like a Rorschach test in terms of what's happening. And I think it's, you also need to segment it by what is the Bureau saying and what is the Bureau doing. And I think in terms of what is the Bureau or the director saying, there's a lot of kind of saber rattling, in a sense, skepticism of use of AI technology, big data, things like that. I mean, I think he's been very public going back to when he was at the FTC about, you know, his views on, you know, all the way back to when there was a Facebook settlement at the FTC, you know, he was public saying he thought it didn't go far enough to hold them accountable.
So do you think we have, by the way, the Office of Anti-Innovation now? I mean, the argument would be that we now have a Bureau which is skeptical of advances in technology. Is that where we're going? Is that what we're saying, that the Bureau now believes innovation is scary, that it could hurt people? Let's walk slowly. I'm just curious.
The OAI, Office of Anti-Innovation. That's good, Tom. I don't think so. I think what you're seeing is a reconception of, it kind of goes back to the point you were positing earlier, your thesis about whether Cordray and Kraniger had a different view of the role of government vis-a-vis innovation. I think that that's actually what's going on. The Bureau has been very public and sort of flexing on the idea that, you know, they're hiring technologists. They have a chief technologist who they brought over from the FTC, and they're boosting their technological knowledge and capabilities. And I think some of that is legitimate in the sense that, you know, they're undertaking some major rulemaking initiatives that are highly focused on technology, like the rule, the 1033 open banking rule. There's a need for that expertise to be integrated into the policy
process. That is such a great point, Mike. I just want to point out, I think you're right on there, that there is a difference between setting up the rules of the road so that a technology can flourish, and that is clearly a rule that the Bureau, so maybe you could just talk a little bit more about that. I mean, that's absolutely right. I totally agree
So,
with you on that.
this is the paradox that like I think we're teasing out here, which is that on the one hand, you're seeing, that commitment to boosting the Bureau's like technical expertise, and then a policy agenda which in part is focused on these issues. And at least, you know, my sense of the 1033 rule is that this is all, you know, I know there's, it's not final yet, and there's, you know, debates about various pieces of it and how they'll be final. But the overall idea is like, if you can move the country to more of an open banking system, you know, that's where you have kind of technology, you know, data integrity standards and things like that, that are able to support that move to open banking, that's going to help consumers in all different ways. So, but on the other hand, you have him making these very public statements, like the Bureau finalized along with the other agencies a rule about automated valuation models, you know, for mortgage appraisals. And, you know, it's somewhat of a technical rule, but Director Chopra, along with the Deputy Director Zixta Martinez, issued a very pointed statement that accompanied their signing off on the rule, where they made statements like, this is part of the Bureau's effort to move away from the Bureau's prior position of giving special privileges and immunities to companies in the AI space. I mean, I have the exact quote, which, you know, really was kind of eye-opening. We've terminated the program that handed out special legal immunities and favors to individual AI companies that they could exploit to gain an unfair advantage. Like, unpack that one sentence. There's so many things going on there. They're throwing the innovation program, which we've just spent several minutes talking about, completely under the bus. In my view, they're very much distorting both the purpose and the execution and operation of that program. You know, as someone who, again, was involved in working with the Office of Innovation on some of the No Action Letter initiatives, like, it was not some sort of, you know, effort. As I said, you know, when you asked me what is the surprise about the Bureau, it wasn't some like super intentional 3D way of trying to do what they're suggesting. It was really an effort, I think, to achieve those goals of trying to reduce regulatory burdens. And so I think statements like this are not helpful because they're not actionable, for one. They're, you know, so what is a company, particularly an innovator, what are they supposed to do with that statement, other than potentially be alarmed or kind of wonder what's next? And then the other point to kind of layer onto this is, you know, your notion of the Office of Anti-Innovation. My sense is that the Innovation Office, now that they've been rebranded as the Office of Competition and Innovation, they're doing things like taking deep dives into areas like, there was a report about gaming and virtual worlds, and there was a report, I think, several months before that about, I don't remember the exact technical term, but, you know, the technology where if you have a debit card, you know, the magnetic part, you know, in terms of like how it links to the payment system, there was a report that they issued about that. And so it seems like what they're doing is they're using those resources and that expertise that they've built up over now 5 years, and they've completely repurposed them to be kind of doing these deep dives on issues where there's there are interesting and important issues related to technology and the use of technology, but they're using it for the purpose of putting industry participants on notice that they need to get in line and they need to comply with existing consumer protection laws. Like, they're not using those resources to actually work and engage with those companies to try to find ways for them to innovate that are maybe working around those laws where there are ambiguities. So just
sort of to wrap up, so I want to throw a thesis out. So for the advice of a ordinary company who's thinking about the Bureau, I'm going to throw out a straw person. Tell me if you think this makes sense or not, that the Bureau still is a very powerful focus for innovation, where you can articulate industry-wide concerns, say it's a 1033 rule or other things, to say, hey, this is how you should build this ship. But in terms of an individual company, I have a cool product and I want to go ahead and sidestep some sort of regulation, that is not really the incentive of this regime. Is that a fair summary, or would you take it a little differently?
No, that's a great summary, Tom. I think the days of that type of one-off engagement, at least unless there's a change in administration, that there could be a revival of the innovation office or these policies. But yes, I think on broader policy initiatives, like I'll give the example of the Fair Credit Reporting rulemaking, which is a major, major rulemaking right now. They're looking at both medical debt and expanding definitions of the Fair Credit Reporting Act related to data brokers and data aggregators and, potentially use of credit header data and things like that. What is the meaning of assembling and evaluating? And so as part of that rulemaking, there is going to be a lot of consideration of kind of the different players in that ecosystem and how that ecosystem has evolved because of technology innovations. So I'm hoping that they will bring to bear on that rulemaking, some of that expertise and that muscle memory that they've developed, writ large. But again, to your point, you're right. I think if a company has an idea, they just kind of want to get a read on where the bureau staff is at, that option is, I think, closed for the time being. I think, there are other ways of engaging, which I think are still useful and helpful. And I've recommended to people, that the agency staff, particularly in the markets offices, always have an open door. And, there are informal discussions with companies all the time, whether they're established or new. And there is a function where in regulations, industry can submit questions and get a call back for oral guidance. So those functions are still happening. It's just you don't have the innovation policies really being promoted anymore, where companies can actually go through a formalized process to get regulatory relief at the end of it.
Mike, thank you so much for sharing all your insight and wisdom with us today, for both to inform and to our audience. That's all the time we have for now. I just want to thank you. And again, I'm Tom Osher with InformedIQ, and remember to stay informed.